Welcome to the Canning Plus 7 podcast. To contact Kevin Williams, send him an email, canningplus7@protonmail.com. That's canning plus the number 7 at protonmail.com. Plus is spelled out when sending him an email.
It is Thursday, December 9th, 2021. I'm Kevin Williams, the Blind Montana Man. This is the Canning Plus 7 podcast. Philip Gleason is my guest today. Philip owns a self-reliance operation community down at the Riverbed Ranch in an hour past Delta. What county are you in again, Phil?
We're in Juab County, Kevin.
Juab County, okay. Juab County, and this is a self-reliant community. Let me tell you what this is not first. This is not an anti-government community, because you've heard of so many communities like this, and you know, some people have the perception that some of them may not be anti-government. This is not an anti-government community. Let's make that clear. This is not the community that is similar or is similar to the community that sprung up in, 1994 with Bo Greitz's community, Almost Heaven. This is not one of those communities. This is just a community where people want to come out and be self-sufficient in case things go wrong in the community. Now, you're going to get, I'm not going to say right-wing extremists, but you're going to get conservative people. You're going to get those that are constitutionalists, but you might have someone like me out there. No, I am not out there. Although it would be kind of cool, we're going to talk about that. You might get people like me who are probably 80% conservative, 20% liberal, somewhere around there. So no, this is not a community of what some may deem as right-wing wackos or some extremists out there like Waco. This is just a community where people want to live off the grid. It kind of reminds me like Ayn Rand's community, if you've read the book Atlas Shrugged. It kind of reminds me of her self-sustaining community. What do you think, Phil? Is that a pretty good description?
Well, that's a good start. Let me add to it a little bit. It's an actual agricultural cooperative. It's created under Title III of the Utah Code, but it is based on agricultural producers. And the Utah legislators put together a really cool piece of legislation that helps the small agricultural producer get a leg up. We happen to have a 1,245-acre ranch out here that's set up with 250 homesteads, and it's incredible people that want to be self-reliant, that have integrity, people who like people. They understand choices have consequences, and they've got to have some resources because you can't go into debt building your homestead out here. We believe that to be totally self-reliant, you can't be beholden to the bank. So that makes a narrow demographics. Now, I'll conclude this with four types of preparation we do. We look for people who are like-minded, who want to be self-reliant. We try to connect them or network them with essential resources. And then there's the education element. We happen to have the Academy of Self-Reliance, a 501c3 that has 40 webinars, essentially help people put together their pathway or their transition from a city lifestyle of dependencies to a country culture of self-reliance. And we help qualify their transition plan, and we organize them into these agricultural communities. This is the first one that we've got off the ground. We hope in the future to be able to do more, but it's a nonprofit. So consequently, you get the equivalent of two plus acres with water rights involved in the community here, and we can get into more detail, but it's essentially $25,000. So it's, like I say, it's a nonprofit, and you don't see a lot of these because there's no money in it for developers.
Yeah, let's just back up a little bit and talk about Philip Gleason real quick, and then we'll get right back into this. So you got into this because I guess you were living at Mountain Home Air Force Base, what, back in 1981, 40 years ago, correct?
Correct. Correct.
And there was a, I guess, I don't know where you were, but you were on vacation somewhere for a week and you came back and, oh, the water pipes were frozen and the power was out. And I guess something happened. You snuggled your babies up into blankets, your kids. And I assume that you had a baby. You snuggled them all up in blankets. And about a half hour later, they were crying. And I guess you couldn't get the water back on in 5 hours. Tell us about that experience and how it changed you and what you were feeling at the time.
I'll be happy to do that. That was a pivotal moment in my life. We had three little baby girls, three and under. We were following construction. I was working on the Mountain Home Air Force Base. There was a big commissary project that we were working on. And so I was staying in Mountain Home with my family in a trailer park. And it was only supposed to last 6 months and ended up lasting 18 months. And so we ended up spending the winter up there. When it came time during the holidays, they shut down the project for a week and we decided to go see grandma and grandpa, take the babies. And we didn't worry about propane because it'd been lasting 2 weeks and we were only going to be gone a week. Anyway, while we were gone, it turned bitter cold. In fact, when we showed up that Sunday night, it was about 0 degrees outside. And in our 29-foot travel trailer, it was 0 degrees inside.
Oh,
now, Mountain Home back then, the roads rolled up, you know, or the sidewalks rolled up at after 6 o'clock. So there was nothing open when we got there at midnight. And this was, you know, we were young. We had spent our money on Christmas, but we had a paycheck we were picking up on Monday, so we didn't give it a thought. But anyway, we got in that trailer. I couldn't give them a drink because the water was all frozen. I couldn't feed them because there was no way to heat up any of the baby food. Everything was frozen. This was before wet wipes. I couldn't even change them adequately. But we did have an electric blanket and the electricity was on in the park. And so we put the three babies between my sweetheart and I. And at midnight, we had the electric blanket on high, our coats and other blankets on top of that. And we were okay until about 3 a.m. in the morning when the power went out. And keep in mind, 0 degrees inside, that matched the 0 degrees outside, and it only took a half hour for the cold to get to those babies. And I was unable, my Colleen and I were unable to keep these babies warm. And of course it was exacerbated, not being able to give them a drink, not being able to feed them or change them. That next 2.5 hours rewired my brain, Kevin. The next morning I had two more sources of heat and I vowed I would never have that happen again. But that's not something I wish for anybody, is to not be able to feed your babies, give them a drink, or even keep them warm.
So let's be clear, this park, I guess you said the word trailer park, sounds more like an RV park, and I guess they didn't have their own heating system, but they did have electricity, correct?
They did have electricity. It was just like a little RV trailer park. And we were there temporarily while I was working on the project and in the Air Force Base about 10 miles away.
Okay. And I guess what? This was over Thanksgiving week?
No, this was Christmas holiday, from Christmas to New Year.
So this got you into the community. This got you into self-reliance. This got you into all kinds of things, you know. And so let's fast forward now. How did this, I mean, obviously you took a lot, you've done a lot of preparation, a lot of research, but when did this self-reliance community come about, the self-reliance operation, and how did that get going? Obviously, I know your story, but let's fast forward to a few years ago when this got up and running.
Well, I've been working at this project for a little over 3 years, and the concept came, and what it was is to create a self-reliant community under what we refer to as OSR, which is Operation Self-Reliance Initiative. And so I put together 24 slides of the concept of creating a self-reliant community that was not reliant on any grid or other resources. In other words, being able to create a community based on two plus acres where each homestead would be totally self-reliant. And what I mean by that, I mean a house, it's a minimum of 600 square feet that was passive solar, so it didn't turn into a freezer if you ran out of fuel in the middle of the winter. A barn. We didn't put a size on the barn because we didn't know if you were going to raise horses or worms, but also a greenhouse that was a minimum of 600 square feet. We recommend a minimum of 1,200. And then an orchard and a garden with their well, your own water source, your own solar power, and approved sanitation. We figured with those six items that you would be able to be totally self-reliant. And then if you made a community of totally self-reliant homesteads, then you would have something that you could really prepare for every needful thing, no matter what happened. And I put that out to 12 different couples to start with. And out of that, I had three couples that I want to get involved over the course of time. And since then, history shows we've sold over, 93, going on 95 shares out of the 250. And we're just getting started on that. We've got wells and houses, but that's the concept. That people are coming out here for health, for safety. But the main reason, Kevin, and this has been interesting, the main reason is a place to raise families, to get a new start.
Okay, this may sound like a dumb question, but your homes are a minimum of 600 square feet, which is not very big. How do you raise? Because I looked on the website. By the way, if you're interested, go check out the website, www.osrcommunity.com. And there is another website while we're talking about websites here, www.academysr.com. Go check those out. But I looked at the website, www.osrcommunity.com. There were people there that had 5 to 8 kids. This may sound like a dumb question, but how do you fit so many people in a 600 square foot house?
Well, keep in mind, that's a minimum. We got people building 5,000, 6,000 square foot house. In fact, I was just talking to three new shareholders this morning, and they're planning on dropping $1 million onto their homestead. Other people are working with a lot less. But let me put it in perspective. Okay. In China, the average household or house or home is 600 square feet. In Japan, the average home size is 800 square feet. Now, here in the United States, back in the 20s and the 30s, when families were larger, the average home size was 800 square feet. So you can build a single bedroom, 600 square feet, or a two bedroom, two bath, 800 square foot home, but it comes down to not what you want, but what's necessary and what fits your budget. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I think I got it mixed up because you said minimum, and for some reason in my head, I was thinking of maximum. I thought, wow. Although I guess you could bring one of those tiny homes out there, but you want people to custom build the homes. In fact, you've got to submit. Let me just go over what's required in this, and we're going to get into this a little bit deeper. I want to also get into some of the people. This is an amazing concept here, something I'm definitely interested in. You can't just go, and we covered this a little bit. you can't just go to the website and contact Phil and say, I want to be in your community. There's a lot of steps. You have to, like Phil said, he connects you with like-minded people. Then there's the academy. You have to take a bunch of lessons, do a bunch of assignments. And then he'll partner you up with people. I'm sure in somewhere in the process, I'm under the impression you probably get a mentor. A real estate guy comes by and assesses your home and says, here's what you need to do. That real estate guy is Tom. I can't remember his last name, but Tom something. Now
that's Tom Swallow. And that's just, he's just one of the resources that's available to help people. It's not required that you go through Tom.
Okay, because I was going to ask, what about me here in Montana wanting to move here?
Yeah, he has made himself available because we've had a lot of people say, I don't even know how to go about selling my house. Other people say, well, I've got some remodeling I want to do to it. And Tom has donated his time and said, for individuals who want me to come look at and tell them, say, okay, you can put this money into a remodel and you'll get it back, but here's something that you'll lose your money on, and here's other things that you can sell it as is, or you can put this money in, but you'll just turn it over. So that's just a service to one of our shareholders. And let me back up just a little bit. The concept Operation Self-Reliance Initiative is a complex cooperative of private capital and education. And it's a bunch of entities. It's not one single deep pockets, some controlling interest. It's not that at all. It's a group of people who want to be self-reliant, who are looking for a pathway to do it. And we're finding that as more and more people get on board with this initiative, there's more and more individuals wanting to help, more and more individuals that are providing essential resources, making them available. I have story after story that I can share with you, but just keep in mind it's a interesting composite of these types of individuals. I'm finding that they have a wealth of knowledge. We've got doctors, engineers, contractors, educators, retired people. Our demographics go from mid-20s to mid-70s. And it's amazing the breadth and depth of knowledge that's coming to the table with 80, 90 families. I mean, it's been exciting to get to know these people.
Yeah, let's go over some of the people because you've got some amazing people. Steve Marks. Steve Marks is a guy that lived in Florida, owned his own communication company. Then he went to North Carolina, and I don't know the order, but at some point he went to North Carolina, started his own, I guess, company that makes CD-ROMs. I don't know what he made on the CD-ROMs, and then started with Microfish. Not only that, but he did put a cell phone tower out in your community, and I suppose you're probably going to have a few cell phone towers out there by the time this is said and done. So this is not somewhere where you're completely off the grid. You still have internet, you still have technology. What did it take to get the cell phone tower put in there, and what company did you go with? I assume you went with the Verizon Wireless, since that's a predominant provider out there where you are.
Well, actually, we were able to put in an amplifier antenna, and that worked well with AT&T, as long as the weather cooperated. But like right now, I've been out here at the ranch. My sweetheart and I, we've been living out here over a year now, but we're utilizing HughesNet. And HughesNet has a phone system that comes with it, kind of like a landline, but it is all satellite. And so I do a lot of Zoom meetings during the week. And I have to tell you, a bunch of us out here have already signed up for Starlink. And we got word here last week. Looks like Starlink will be coming online sometime in January out here.
Oh, that's so exciting. That's a great provider too. No, this is not an advertisement, by the way, for those purists out there. No, this is just, this is a provider owned by Elon Musk. Very good provider.
So, yeah, we're not interested in going back to the 1800s. We're interested in being self-reliant. And, you know, as long as we have access to Home Depot and Walmart, we're going to take advantage of those when we go back and forth. But we want to get our infrastructure in place, each one of us, so that in the event there is an extended power outage, fuel might get interrupted, whatever, we just want to be able to keep doing what we're doing, and that is raising food and families and just be one of the best neighbors around.
Now let's talk about Tiffany. Tiffany is a certified instructor in math, and she has a teaching degree and raises five kids. Drew, I guess, is a construction worker, and he likes to figure out problems and solve them, whether it's through YouTube or whatever he can. And according to your website, he's quite the construction worker. They have five kids. Why don't you talk a little bit about that couple real quick?
Well, that's Drew and Tiffany Dowmuller, and they had a family change. So they've ended up down in Arizona, and they've set up a place, but he is a structural engineer that helped us get things going. Now, let me give you an idea of some of the people that are out here now. Actually, Mark Miller, he's a nurse, okay? He's moving into 60 years old. He has delivered over 800 babies. He worked for the World Health Organization for 23 years. He worked with Mother Teresa. He's been in 85 countries. Mark has set up his homestead out here. He's got his solar up. He's got his well. He's working on his home out here. And he's also established helping to set up our clinic. He's working with another shareholder we have out here who is in the process of having his home built. Let me put it that way. He's not out here at this point, but his home is framed up and has the solar on it. But that's Dr. Charles Miller, who is just retired as a family physician last year. And by the way, his neighbor next door is Mary Miller, his daughter, who is a nurse. And then I'll just go down the road. The next gentleman over is Mike and Sarah Vizzani. He's currently building a straw bale barn. And in the spring, he's going to be building his straw baled home, of which he and his wife went and were certified in this type of construction. And I might mention that Sarah is a chemical engineer and a certified project manager, and she's currently studying to be a master herbologist. And her cottage industry that she's working on, she's already planted her herbal garden of substantial size, but she is making tinctures. And but with her background in chemistry, she gets right down into how various chemicals interact with the body and that. And then I'll just go to their neighbor, which is Kevin and Carol Vizzani. Carol Vizzani is, she's actually one of the board of directors. She is a hardcore self-reliant individual. In fact, she taught me about freeze drying, Kevin. She was out there last January at about 10 degrees, hanging up clothes. And I they have four kids, the oldest 14, she was out hanging up clothes and there was snow on the ground. And I live about 100 yards away from her. So I went down, Carol, what in the world are you doing? She said, I'm drying my clothes. I said, I just laughed. I'm looking at the snow, I'm seeing this. And she says, let me show you. And she says, I just hung this up a few minutes ago. Notice how stiff it is. Well, yeah, it froze. And then she takes the one next to it and she shakes it, and it's just like a wiggly rag. And she says, I hung this up yesterday and it's freeze dried. So I'll be taking that down and hanging the other way up. Just wow. So I learned the original freeze drying from Carol. Now, her husband, by the way, is an electrical tech that works on submarines and oil rigs out in the ocean. And he's been invaluable in setting up solar systems out here and troubleshooting other electronic stuff like that. But that's just the four neighbors across the street from me.
Let's talk about Sarah Garlick. She is, I guess, a designer and has a passion in being a minimalist. And let's get into her a little bit. She sounds like an interesting individual. Interesting in a good way, I will add.
I appreciate that bringing up. Sarah, I've got to update that website. Sarah got ill, and so she pulled back out of that project. She's still talking about it, but she has pulled back. Let's see. We've got Eric Cleaver and his wife, Jill, out here. He's a contractor and designer. He's just finishing up a 5,000 square foot house that he has. And he also has done a joint venture with the co-op. And what he wanted to do as his cottage industry is he's put in a concrete batch plant and a sand and gravel pit right here on the property. We have all of that. And so he's helped with some of the designs. And let's see.
What about Larry Jones? He's the one who built your website.
Yes. Larry's out here with his wife, Jenny. He happens to be the chairman of the board. And Larry is a professional beekeeper in the past and a welder. And then he became he went and got his degree in IT. And he worked for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was a quality control engineer over several of the websites. And in fact, Larry was the second one that came on the project. And that was an interesting story. After he heard my presentation down on Lake Powell with some of our other friends, he contacted me 2 weeks later and said, Philip, I want to participate. And I said, well, Larry, I appreciate that. I don't have any money. And he said, I didn't ask for any money. He says, I want to participate. And it turned out that was the very next thing that we needed was a web presence. And so he and his daughter, Sarah, who is a web designer, so they've not only built the OSR community website and we're currently hosting the Utah OSR Land Co-op website, but also they put together the Academy of Self-Reliance or academyosr.com.
Oh, okay.
And his contribution has been immeasurable. A very smart man, and he's a true leader. He's very thoughtful before he makes decisions. And he and his wife, they've got a house out here that they've started. They've got their basement up. They've got a well in. Water storage is going in. But yeah, they are incredible people. In fact, he's covering for me right now. We've got a shipment, about almost $200,000 solar shipment coming in from people that have ordered inverters and batteries from Solark, and he's covering for me and unloading those. So great, great people.
Let's talk about the last person I want to talk about, then I want to ask some questions. Let's talk about Shawnee and her son, Sam, or her husband, Sam. I think you pronounce it Shawnee, correct?
Oh, yes, out of Provo. Like I say, I need to update this. She passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, Yeah, she passed away here about a year ago. And but amazing people. He's gone on to he was a pharmacist, and he's gone on to receive his training for alternative health. So we've got a lot of cool people that haven't been able to make the transition out here because of family issues or health, a couple other things that come up. But I want to take my hat off to all these people that you've mentioned. They were the ones that helped open the doors and that have made way for the 90 plus people that are already, that have come on board since then.
Does
that
make sense? Let me ask you this, and I want to get back into the community itself. How difficult is it for somebody to make the transition? For example, let me just ask you this. Somebody like me who is blind and was raised in the city all of my life. Yes, I've had a taste of farm life here and there, but most of my life was spent in the city, with the exception of a vacation here and there, going out to see my sister in Idaho or whatever. Okay, so somebody like me comes along. I know nothing about building. I know nothing about agriculture. The one thing I do know how to do, though, is be a ham radio operator. Now, I'm no expert. I don't know how to ground antennas or anything like that. What would you do for somebody like me who's blind, taking this academy, needs a lot of hands-on to understand what you're doing? Take me through that process of what you would do with me or somebody who's in a wheelchair or something like that.
Well, we actually have people out here that are handicapped. And the fact that you bring up the blind, I've had a lot of opportunity to talk with another individual. I won't use his name right now, but he's thinking of coming out here. And he's having to sell his business because he is going legally blind. And so we've talked in detail about that. There's two things that you can do. You can either operate agriculturally productive land, or you can own agriculturally productive land and fall under the agricultural producer as required by statute in the state of Utah. So what he and I have been talking about is that, okay, he has the resources to put this together. It hasn't been a problem. And he's also concert pianist. And so what he wanted to do to contribute to the community was to give music lessons. I have to kind of laugh. He said, children who don't have any talent, but their parents are going to force them to do music, he says, I'll charge them for lessons. But he said, those that have the real gift and skill, I'll teach them for free. So that was just an interesting sidelight. But what we have is several other families out here that were looking for part-time help or want to increase the amount of productivity. And so they were willing to share crop with him. And of course, we have contractors that can build his house and put up his barn, his greenhouse and garden. But there's plenty of opportunity for people who want to participate. And I know the fact that you are talked to Milt a little bit about you, and I know that you've got some skill sets and ability to teach if need be. And so there's a lot of opportunity for somebody like you out here, but you would need to want to be in this environment. Second of all, like people, which I can already tell you to do that. And but you'd have to have some resources in order to establish yourself. But it's not a closed community. It's a very open community. In fact, several of the things that we have for the long range term out here, you know, the next 3-5 years is to put in an assisted living retirement home out here, you know, about a 15-bed unit. Also, we're in the process of putting together designs for a clinic with a trauma room. And in fact, we're already setting up a trailer, a fifth wheel out here with the clinic. And there'll be some treatments that are available. But we have one family out here whose the mother is in either in a wheelchair or a walker. And excuse me. And they're bringing her husband's, excuse me, husband's mother out here. And while they're building their home and getting ready for this, they've taken an RV and put it under a greenhouse. And so they're moving their mother-in-law in the other end of the greenhouse in another RV until they get their home built. So I have to say, if there's a will, there's a way. And it's been pretty amazing watching individuals out here adapt, find solutions. And that's one thing about the type of people that are coming out here. They're problem solvers. They're not hand wringers. And I'll give you one example of that. When we first got out here, all the wells had been abandoned. We have a lot of water rights. And since then, we've reclaimed 5 of the wells and we've drilled another 14 wells. And we're getting ready to drill another 200. We've been working with the state on that. But we had a well up by the Welcome Center, and we finally got it reclaimed, got a pump in it, but it would only give us about 7 gallons a minute, and we wanted 20 gallons a minute. So we brought the professionals out here, the pump company, and they looked at it and said, yeah, we can help you with that. That'll be $6,000. And I said, okay, $6,000, go from 7 to 20 gallons a minute. What is it you're actually going to do? And he hem-hawed around. Anyway, I kept poking at it until he finally said, well, we use a potable acid. And I say, okay, $6,000 acid, you know, that sounds pretty intense. So let me go check with my team. And we got together several of us and we said, okay, here's the objective. We want more water. One of the solutions is instead of drilling a new well, use a potable acid, see if we can clean up the well. And one of the team members said, well, you know, vinegar is a potable acid. So we said, okay. So we went and bought 15 gallons of vinegar and we spent $50. Fish and chips?
And pop?
Nope, but we dropped in 5 gallons, let it set overnight, pumped it out, dropped in another 5 gallons, let it set overnight, pumped it out, did that the third time, and we got 20 gallons a minute for $50. That's what self-reliant mentality does. Instead of wringing your fingers and your hands and throwing money at it, they solve the problem.
So wait, okay, and I so can give enlighten you a story me here. You put this vinegar in the water pump, or how did the vinegar? I'm a little confused here.
Okay, we have a 6-inch well casing that goes down 175 feet in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of time, and this well is probably 30, 40 years old, but over the course of time, some of the hard water has filled in the screen and the perforations made at the bottom of the well casing. So when you drop the pump down there, it can only pull out the water that is coming through those holes. And if those holes have been filled in with hard water, that restricts the amount of water that the well can produce. So the vinegar dissolved the hard water.
Okay, so you drop the vinegar right down into the well then. No water pump. You just pour it down in the 15 gallons of vinegar?
Yes, we did it in 3 5-gallon treatments.
Oh, man, I wonder if that tastes nasty.
And that dissolved that hard water. Well, it did, and it tasted like vinegar for about the first 3 days, but after that, it cleared up, and it was great. And that was a year and a half ago.
I guess if you had a water filter, an expensive water filter, I guess it could have filtered out the vinegar, couldn't it?
Yeah, but we just pumped it out. We just pumped it out until all the new fresh water come in and washed it all away. And so it was a non-issue.
So that's what you did then, is you poured the vinegar down this pipe, and then you waited for about 3 to 5 days. I'm sure you turned the water on every so often to make sure that the vinegar was doing what it was supposed to. And then after 3 to 5 days, the pump was working as it should, correct?
Yes. In other words, the well was producing the water, the amount of water that we needed. The pump was able to pump it. It's just that the water coming into the well casing was being restricted because of the hard water buildup. For example, if you've got a shower head and it gets filled up with hard water, then it starts restricting the flow of water that comes through your faucet or your shower head. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Now, let me just argue with you just for a minute here, just because I know what people are thinking. Okay, why didn't Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so buy a water softener to soften up the water and make it pump more gallons into their home or whatever? What would you say to that? Because somebody's got to be asking that question out there when they hear this part of the podcast.
I appreciate that. This would be the same thing. This is when you're dealing with a well. I'm going to equate that to water coming in through your meter out at the street.
Okay.
So once the water comes into your house, you can treat it. But if the water gets restricted prior to coming through the meter and you can only get a little bit of water, you have to go to the source and find out what's restricting it. So whether it's plugged with hard water buildup or something's caught in the strainer or whatever, but this is like a well, you put a pipe down in the ground and it generally goes into a gravel area. And so the water that's in the gravel area is what comes through the holes in the well casing. And then you have a pump at the bottom of that well, and that pump will then pull the water up, but it can only pull up as much water as the holes in the casing are allowing. So if you have restricted water, if the water is restricted coming into the well casing, then your pump can only pull out so much. And that would be the same as, say, you had a big line going out to the city supply line to the meter, but it was either a bent pipe or something got in and it was plugging it and it would only give you a little bit of water, then you would have to solve the issue at the source and not treat it after it came to you, if that makes sense now.
Okay, that makes more sense, yes. Now, keep in mind, you're talking to a guy that was raised in the city and knows hardly anything about agriculture, well water, which is why I started this podcast. Let me remind you folks out there. But yes, okay, that makes much more sense. Now, is this the well that you talked about on the news update that took 2 weeks to build?
This may be. It may be.
Because I know on the website it talked about how you dug a well and it took 2 weeks and then you figured it all out. Obviously, this well was dug, but is this that well or is that a different one?
No, that's a different well.
Okay.
That's a different well. We've actually drilled... We've reclaimed 4 of the 5 wells, and we're just about ready the 6th well that were originally on the property. Since then, we've drilled 12 others, and we've got another 240 wells to drill. And so working with the state on all that, we have a ton of water rights. Here in the state of Utah, water rights are like land. In other words, you own the water right. You may own land, but you may not own any water to go with it. So you want to make sure that when you buy land out here, there's water allocated to it or comes with it, or you can purchase it. Now, to give you an idea, we have 1,245 acres, but for water rights, we have the right to 2,854 and a half acre feet, which gives us almost 1 billion gallons of water a year out here. So we have a lot of water out in the middle of the desert.
Now, this well that you're talking about where you put vinegar down and the well that took 2 weeks to drill, are these community wells? Because I heard you say earlier in the podcast that you had to have your own individual well. These wells, that the one that you built and the one that you put vinegar down, are these community wells for things like a private school or whatever?
Yeah, we have 5 community wells. So while people are waiting to get their own well, these courtesy wells, they can come and get water. And so we have 5 of those. 4 of them are currently up and running, and we're working on the 5th one. The 5th one is a very large one and will only be used in emergency. It's a 300 horsepower. They'll provide 1,800 gallons a minute. And that'll essentially be for irrigation for a bunch of acreage that we have, or for fire suppression.
Thank you for listening to the Canning Plus 7 podcast. If you have a recommendation or suggestion, email Kevin Williams at canningplus7@protonmail.com. Remember, when emailing him, the plus is spelled out instead of the plus sign. You can also check him out at Facebook at canningplus7. That's canningplus7 with the plus symbol instead of the word plus on the Canning Plus 7 Facebook page.